All right, this is week two of this version of Understanding the News called WWT. And so I told you that the title of that can be whatever you want it to be. World War III or World War Against Terror, whatever it is. The purpose, as I said, and this is my quick review of what we're doing, is we're trying to take a look at some of the things that we hear often in the news and look at it beyond the political, but look at it with a lens that allows us to see it through a biblical lens and get a biblical understanding. As I shared with you, I'm not real anxious about what your politics are or aren't. Not that I don't care, but I don't care. As much as I care that we at least try to see the world through a biblical lens, and then use that as your starting point to make decisions and conclusions and application to your life that allows you then to come up with whatever political views you got or whatever personal preferences you got, but start with God first and then go from there. Instead of doing what a lot of people do, is we start with what we think and then we ask God to fit into that. And that's a struggle in every area of life, but it's also a struggle as you watch or listen to the news. And so last week we talked about what this means, at least in this context, where we're looking at understanding or trying to get a handle on terrorism above the hubbub or the roar of politics and pundits and news channels. And this is the third time we've done this particular thing. We've tackled already a look at the Arab-Israeli conflict, and we tried to give you a biblical view of what that, where that starts and then how to view that. And so, you know, some of you have listened to that. If not, they're all online now, with the exception of the one we didn't get. And you can listen to that. We also did a series on the Russian revolution, and we talked about Russia from a biblical worldview, except for the last piece of prophecy on the week that I was out, and I promised we would come back to that. We will.
Sometime,
yes. But I don't want to prophesize when, because that would be
Could you at least give us three signs that would happen before?
I would mention it. It would be here. And then we'll go on. And then so last week we started our series on understanding terrorism. And I said, as always, you kind of get into that high weed, tricky water, where even as we talk about this, the tendency will be to hear it through your politics or your political preference as opposed to where the Bible is. And last week, some of you walked out and actually emailed me this week because you were surprised at some of the things we said and some of the things we talked about, because there were things you had not heard, but at the same time, they were things that were helpful in kind of understanding what it is. And I made the statement last week that when you call what we know today as terrorism as radical Islamic extremism, that's not a bad thing. But it begs the question that we start with this week as we start to review, and then we're going to jump into our ancient history here, because it is increasingly difficult in the world that we live in to be anti-radical Islamic without being perceived as anti-Muslim. I mean, that's a struggle point. And if you watch the news and you listen to the news even yesterday, it happened yesterday. Because all across America, the march against Sharia happened in a variety of towns and a variety of places. And in a variety of towns and a variety of places, that was met with certain resistance or certain excitement or certain protest and then some extreme violence pieces. But in stepping back from it, and recognizing the importance of understanding this topic for us in dealing with the world of terror. See, I suggested years ago, as we started kind of looking, going down this road as a nation, that it would be impossible to ever address terrorism without ever understanding, in some way, understanding Islam. And now, that's wildly offensive to some people, just saying that. But it ought not to be. And we took our guys over to a two-day event where we had a big, broad overview of understanding Islam. And it was really interesting. It was really heady, and it was kind of like sitting in seminary class again in some ways. I mean, it was easy to get bogged down, and it was easy to go to sleep. But and I did that a lot in seminary, but it was helpful in a lot of ways as well. But let me put it in context. Someone said more than once last week that the context or the illustration we used last week of saying, well, you have cancer, but let's treat it like the flu. And we kind of illustrated that a little bit. I said, well, how stupid would that be if you didn't call it what it was and tried to treat it as something else? And I said, and that's the problem when you try to deal with terrorism without understanding Islamic terrorism. And so that's kind of how we kind of... But so let's say we woke up to this morning's headlines where a group of people drug into the street someone from a gathering, picked up rocks and stoned them to death because they didn't agree with their ideology. That same group, although it caused a ruckus in the Winter Springs Town Center, took a lamb and executed it there in the town square. Cut its head off, drained the blood out of it, and then flung it on themselves. But then when they were done with that, although there was an uproar about it, they did the same thing with a goat. We would say, that's nuts. And then the counter would be, well, no, that's not nuts. That's just us returning to the historical roots of Judaism. And we go, no, that's crazy. You can't do that. Well, yes, I can, because I'm just returning to the basics of my faith. And we'd all walk out the door going, well, that's some radical extreme Judaism. Yes, we would. And not only would we, but we would be allowed, and it would be allowable to do that, and everybody would get that. Same group, for example, let's say, filed suit against Seminole County because their employer made them walk over 200 feet at their job or their place of employment on what they consider to be the Sabbath day. And so they couldn't go any further, and it was too much work. But when the employer fired them, they said, no, you can't do that, because you have now crossed the line into my religious freedom, because this is the brand of Judaism that I am now practicing. And we would go, that's crazy. If the person hires you, you ought to be able to do that. That would be radical extreme Judaism. Exactly. And we would be right to do that. And so now we come back again to the term that is the buzzword that gets everybody hot, radical extreme Islam. And again, understanding the importance of saying that is understanding that becomes the descriptive word. For example, you might be surprised to find out that last year, according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, there were 1,114 hate crime incidents motivated by religious bias. 15.2% of those were anti-Islamic. So it is a problem? Sure. But over 55% of them were anti-Jewish. Which is a bigger problem. Well, it's not a matter of being bigger. It's all a problem. The bigger problem in that is that one you can talk about, one you can't. Simply because of the world that we live in and the fear of describing terrorism and putting it under the banner of Islam. Because, see, every American, including Muslims, have an inalienable right to live without fear and intimidation and practice religious ideas without interference. But here's the issue. The issue is the practice of one's faith that may be incompatible with the provisions of the Constitution, upholding the laws of the land and expecting citizens' compliance with those laws. That's why in the Winter Springs Town Squares we're not sacrificing animals today. If someone does that, should they be arrested? Yes. Do they have the right to do it? No. No. And someone will hear this. I know they will hear it. And they'll go, well, what about radical extreme Christianity? Okay, well, I haven't found anything in my Christianity yet that has me out sacrificing animals. I don't have anything in my Christianity that allows me to go out and stone people. I don't have any rules in my Christianity that says I can't work on the Sabbath and do a certain amount of work for an employer as long as I have to honor a Sabbath day somewhere. And the Sabbath, defined, as I understand it from a Christianity standpoint, is that moment of reflection with you reconnecting with God. So, I mean, radical extreme Christianity, I don't necessarily find great evidence of the problems of that. And when someone says, well, you know, I'm doing this under the name of Christ, well, okay, no, you're really not. I mean, that's not radical extreme Christianity, that's radical stupidity. and that is a problem. Now, again, and that is common sense, but understand, like we said last week, that common sense is not common. And it doesn't always make sense to people. And so that is the context we set to say that in understanding the news, the contention of this is, if you want to have a conversation about terrorism, that conversation always puts you into the realm of Islamic terrorism, or you're not really having a conversation about terrorism. You're having a conversation about violence. And so understanding that then means that as you hear pundits, as you hear people talk, as you hear people say whatever they're going to say, you have to phrase it that way, or you have to at least have that understanding of it, because if the global war against terrorism or a world war on terror, or if you ever want to eliminate terrorism from the world stage, it can't be done without having that drawback to understanding Islam and that faith and the belief system that's involved in that. It is that simple in a very complicated world. And it puts you in some real touchy places. Because if you really look at it honestly, Islamic extremists are a threat to Muslims because they will kill more Muslims than anybody else. They're a threat to Jews and a threat to civilization. And unapologetically, they are a threat on purpose to those things. And so there shouldn't be anything offensive in that. But it's an honest appraisal of where you have to look to start the conversation to make it better or different, and at least understand it. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, you don't walk away from a series like this and go, well, we're going to make it better and different. No, you're not. You're at least going to understand it, and hence the title, We're Understanding the News. But it does really help cut through the chatter and the clutter of what you hear, and even this week, there's just a lot of chatter and clutter out there. And this morning I just went back and I looked at some of the news headlines from the things that happened yesterday. I mean, and it's just all over the planet, and it's crazy. It's crazy. And it's also not spiritual and not Christian. And so, you know, is there value in a Christian worldview? You bet your bottom dollar. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you need to have one, you bet your bottom dollar. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, are you commanded to have one? I think you are. Because when the call to take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow him becomes a part of who you are and what drives you, then you will follow him differently. And that then opens up the door to looking at the world differently and understanding things. And so that's kind of what the background is on that. Does that help at all? And that understand? I mean, again, agree, disagree, okay. You know, you may or may not, I may not like it. I got that. That's okay. But does that make sense? I mean, because again, there is that moment where, yes, our freedoms and our beliefs are all guaranteed by the Constitution here in this country, but that also doesn't mean that all the protections that we might want, we have. And it also doesn't give me the freedom to interpret Christianity with my own brand of Christianity that would then give me the license to do things that are outside of the cultural and societal normalcy that keeps people safe and doesn't break the laws of this land. If it did, there'd already be a hole in that wall. I would run a garden hose in the building to take care of the sprinkler system. I have 15 sheds out back that all have extension cords to them with air conditioners in them. Now, the city of Winter Springs decides not to let me do that. Have they now impeded upon my expression of faith? And I will cry, yes, they have. And somebody's going to go, you're a nut. And I'll say, no, I'm just a radical extreme Baptist. And all of that may be true, but guess what? At the end of the day, I don't have 15 sheds out back. I don't have extension cords running to all of them. We don't have a hole in the wall yet, and there's no garden hoses running in the building. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you think
nope.
that there are...
What do you think?
Okay. Do you think there are events that are considered to be terror events that are not related to extreme radical Islam?
Sure, there are. Of course there are. There has to be.
Do you think that sometimes they get labeled as radical Islam when they really are not?
Probably. That would seem... That would seem... Yeah, so awesome, a pacemaker. It would just make sense. Yeah, I mean, I would think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that are hate crimes that are branded hate crimes that are probably just crimes. But is crime driven by hate? Yeah. Is it driven by sin? Yeah. It's driven by a whole lot of things. I mean, yeah, I think there would have to be, and I think the world. I mean, culturally, I think right now. You know, I mean, how often is it that everybody, you know, when something breaks into, well, the shooting in Orlando this past week, you know, I mean, how many hours did we spend waiting to find out, well, why is the FBI already on the scene? It must be terrorism. Nope, it's not. Disgruntled employee was fired in the spring, came back, and, you know, and opened fire on his coworkers, and the guy had a past where, you know, he'd already been a problem, and they were already afraid of him, but he showed up, and he killed everybody, which, again, is that a crime? Yes. Is it crazy? Yes. Is it evil? Yes. Is it tragic? Yes. Is it horrible? Yes. Is it terrorism? Oh, nope. You know, but we spent hours waiting for that word. And you know what? At the end of the day, if it had been terrorism, does it make it any worse? Nope. It doesn't. But we have to be able to look back and say that honestly. You know, yeah, I mean, but we live in the reason we live in a world, though, that way that does it right now is, you know, I mean, what was the goal? In the midst of Ramadan, there will be an attack every day. And, wow. That was kind of played out, you know, on the world stage, you know. I mean, and praise God for us as followers, it wasn't happening in Central Florida. But it doesn't make the world any less dangerous and terrorism any less real. It just is the world that we live in. Which is why it's so hard, you know, to process the news in general. And why it can just eat you up if you're not careful and you don't have the lenses in place, because it will make you crazy. Because as we've often said, you know, because there's always someone out there that will tell you what they want you to hear and what they want you to believe. And so last week we also, that answer?
Yeah.
Okay. Last week we talked about what the process of how ISIS as we know it has developed, and very quickly it started with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It then became ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which we know it as today. It then became ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and we said that became a political problem for those that were on television talking about things, because we had a U.S. president that called it ISIL when everyone else was calling it ISIS, and they kept saying he didn't want to call it ISIS because he was somehow watering it down. But the reality was he was actually calling it what the organization was calling itself in some ways. I mean, it was actually a very good way to say it. It probably said it better. And then we talked about the phrase that dash that was used by our Secretary of State that everyone thought, well, he doesn't want to call it, Islamic at all. But then I shared with you something that some of you didn't know, that Muslim opponents of ISIS refer to the organization as Daesh, because that is a form of derision or scorn. And ISIS officials have said that anybody that utters that word publicly should have their tongue cut out. So if you want to call them something that they hate, call them Daesh. But again, it became a political term because you could listen to one cable news network that would say, well, the Secretary of State won't call it ISIS because they don't want to use the word Islamic. Well, what he actually was using was a phrase that was an affront or an offense. Now, were there political reasons? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, the world seems to be driven by politics sometimes. But at the end of the day, it was a pretty darn good way of saying it. If you wanted to say it and really stick it to them. But again, I don't think any news organizations reported that I heard. Still don't, by the way. Today, the Islamic State is called IS. It's the current name for the organization. It includes Islam and State, which summarizes its goal of uniting the Muslim religion into a single powerful political entity. And the name also eliminates geographical references because they prefer this to these because this has a worldwide connotation to it. It's not in Iraq and Syria. It's not just limited to the Middle East. It's a worldwide movement. And so this is the preferred, if there is such a thing as political correctness, in that world that they use today. And so that's kind of where we've been. That's what we look at. Okay? Wow, that was a long review. Sorry. All right. So let's go back, though, and let's pick it up, because it's easy to think that this has just popped up in the past two or three decades. It hasn't. We go back to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Let's pick up the ancient history of ISIS. And somebody read for us, if you wouldn't mind, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. It's a promise that God makes to Abraham.
The Lord said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go into the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the people on earth will be blessed through you.
God promised to make Abraham the father of a great nation. And most of you know the story of Abraham and his two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. But at the time that promise is made, in Genesis 12, Abraham doesn't have any children. But he depended on God's promise that one would come. Go to Genesis 15:4. And read that out loud, somebody.
Then the Lord said to him, no, your servant will not be your heir, for you will have a son of your own who will be your heir.
Yeah. See, by the time Abraham was 85 years old, Abraham's already figured out, when the promise was made, he's just like, I'm way too old for this. So it's going to have to be somebody, in my household, somebody I know. Some heir, that's how it's going to flesh out. And God says, no, it's going to be your child. Well, Abraham gets 85 years old, Sarah 75, promised heir hasn't arrived. So Sarah, or Sarai, depending on where you are in history at that time, falls back on the Mesopotamian law codes and suggested that Abraham follow the ancient custom allowed in her homeland. Sarah comes to Abraham and says, I have a great idea. Let's push this promise of God along. You need an heir. According to our laws, from where we've come from, I can't conceive, so we'll get a female servant that can step up and be a surrogate. And they can bear you a child for the couple. So Sarah's servant Hagar bore Abraham's son, and they named him Ishmael. But that was not the son that God had promised. That son was going to come through Abraham and Sarah. Yet God took Ishmael into account and gave him a place in history. Look at Genesis 16:12. An angel of the Lord speaks to Hagar, saying this. I'll read that out loud.
He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers.
What an interesting description. Ishmael is going to be a donkey of a wild man. You can think of a few other adjectives besides donkey that immediately most of you thought of as well. But he's going to be a wild man. His hand is going to be against every man. And every man's hand against him. But then also flip forward again, understanding the history, go to Genesis 17:20. Somebody read that out loud.
And after Ishmael, I have heard you, I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and greatly increase his numbers. He will be a father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation.
God also promised, though, because Ishmael is the son of Abraham, that he would be the father of multitudes as well. 14 years after Ishmael's birth, when Abraham was 100 years old and Sarah was 90, they had a son. They named him Isaac, who was the son of this covenant promise. Isaac became the patriarch through the great nation promised to Abraham would flow. But look at, we're still in 17, look at verse 18.
So Abraham said to God, if only Ishmael were acceptable to you.
See, Abraham loved Ishmael. It was a son. But there could only be one son of promise. And Abraham knew that it was not him. God had said it's not him. And that was Isaac. But Abraham loved Ishmael. And in two verses later, we find that God says Ishmael will be the father of multitudes. And this is what it's going to look like. As you can imagine, things did not go well between the two mothers of Abraham's son. Tension and jealousy poisoned the home atmosphere. On the day that Isaac was weaned, look at Genesis 21:9.
But Sarah saw Ishmael, son of Abraham, and her Egyptian servant Hagar, making fun of her son Isaac.
Yeah. On the day that Isaac was weaned, Sarah saw Ishmael and Hagar making fun of Isaac. And she got ticked off. And so as a result, she had Ishmael and his mother banished from the home. It caused a little bit of a problem, as you might imagine. Abraham, in some ways, was heartbroken over that. You can read the details of the story and dig into it yourself. But it also was the foreshadowing of all these things that have followed all these years later. If you get to Genesis 25, and we're not going to look at these verses and let you start reading the names, but go to Genesis 25:12-18. But somebody read verse 12 to us.
This is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael, who Sarah's maidservant and Hagar, the Egyptian, bore to Abraham.
See, Ishmael fathers 12 sons who become ultimately the beginning of all of the modern Arab peoples. And so to understand this, almost all Arabs, including Muhammad, the founder of Islam, look to Ishmael as their father, just as the Jews look to Jacob or Israel, who is the son of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham, as their father. Now, take that is a biblical. This is where it starts. Fast forward from Abraham's sons, and then you have the modern manifestation of what we talked about in the Arab-Israeli conflict course of understanding the news. And we talked about that. We broke that down, so we're not going back there. But it simmered throughout time until 1948, when Israel becomes a state again. And so, again, if you're trying to pick up that history, we did cover it pretty extensively. It's online. You can go download it now. But Israel regains nationhood, steps back onto the world stage. To understand how ISIS now links back into that historical chain, you have to understand two primary factors that fuel the ongoing Arab-Jewish hostility, and that is race and religion. Race and religion. The racial-ethnic conflict first, and then the religious conflict second. The racial rift grows out of the Ishmael-Isaac confrontation that started way back when that we just read about. The religious conflict begins around 600 AD when the religion of Islam emerges. Radical Islam today, their quarrel is not just with Judaism. It's with all religions, including moderate Muslims who don't subscribe to the extreme ideology of ISIS. So when ISIS targets Jews, they do so for both racial and religious reasons. But with ISIS, religion, not ethnicity, is always the primary source of conflict. And ISIS, what they do, what they have done, what they use as their standard, is the standard that they used in the emergence of Islam back in AD 600 and beyond that. In other words, they've gone back. The illustration I started with about what would extreme Judaism look like? What would you take if you used ancient Jewish law and tradition and tried to place it in our society today? We would say that you can't do that. Well, but that's what they have gone back to. And so ISIS, one of the things and one of the ways of operating that drives ISIS is that they hold to a standard of doing business that they held to in the ancient Middle East, which means it's okay then if they behead people. It's okay if they are trying to cleanse a world population, because that holds on to the very basic tenets at the roots of what Islam has said. Now again, do all faiths evolve as culture goes by? Sure they do. Sure they do. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? I don't know. You can judge. I mean, bad thing. But Christianity's done as well. Right? When I'm in seminary in Texas, they have blue laws. So I grew up in Central Florida, go out to Southwestern, go to school. Oh my gosh, the mall's not open on Sunday. All you can do on Sundays is you can go to a movie, which was recent, or go get something to eat at a restaurant. That's the only thing that's open on Sunday. Everything else is closed. That's in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. We're not talking about podunk Luckenbach, Texas, where they only have a stoplight and a bar. We're talking about downtown, big city, Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. They saw blue laws in effect that were removed in the 80s when I was there. And it was a battle, by the way. Big news battle. Oh, Texas is open on Sunday. I was from Florida. Everything was open on Sunday. Well, where was that? That was religious. That was actually driven by Christians in American culture. So, did the culture evolve around faith? Yeah. Is it good or bad? Depends on who you talk to. I personally like to be able to walk through a mall. I mean, but again, some of you will do things today as followers of Jesus because you're a Christian that is perfectly allowable and okay that was not allowed 50, 100, 200, 300 years ago. Is that bad or good? Depends on who you are. I like the good old days, and so some won't like it. I like the way it is now, and they'll like it. Does it matter? Not a bit. Because it doesn't change the basis or the foundation of faith. However, with ISIS, you deal with a very extreme letter of the law application of what a brand of Islam is that they believe is necessary for world domination. if you take a look at the map, not all Muslims are Arabs. There are large populations of non-Arabic Muslims in Turkey, Iran, and Indonesia. Not all Arabs are Muslims. There are Arab Christians as well as Arabs of other religions. And not all members of ISIS are Arabs, though the majority are. But all members of ISIS are definitely Muslim or have agreed to live life by a Muslim standard. That's important. Because that becomes the justification. And here's why. Because you can't be a member of ISIS without subscribing to radical Islamic theology and ideology, or you're not in. That's their rules. That's their standard. That's why calling it what it is becomes important in the context of being able to deal with it. Because if you try to deal with or solve problems on a world stage and not understand the meaning and mindset of where it comes from, you're playing out of a different rule book. Now, does it mean that you shouldn't play out of a different... No, you should play out of a rule book that honors and does what you need it to do as a people. There's no doubt about it. But now we come back to the illustration. You don't treat cancer like the flu. Because if you win, you haven't accomplished anything. So what wins? Cancer wins. I mean, you get to a point where you start running it through the filter of what it takes to move forward. And so ISIS targets anyone whose religion differs from Islam, who occupies land that Muslims previously conquered in the name of Allah, which includes Israel, by the way, as we talked about in the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is now a nation that's occupied primarily or majority-wise by Jews. And so let's take a look at the modern history of ISIS. Now, that was the ancient history. Questions about that? Not that I can answer a lot of them. I just told you everything I know. Which you probably already knew, but it helps me to go back and review it. Questions about that? That I can answer?
But they also respect Abraham and that whole mix.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they do. They do. One of the things that came out, at least, I mean, if any of you were there, in that two-day deal we did in understanding the bigness of Islam is, yeah, I mean, there is a respect for Abraham, certainly, because he's the father of Ishmael. But the belief does not go as far as, where Abraham's son Isaac and then eventually Jacob goes by way of Judaism. They also have a great respect for Jesus as a prophet. And that's certainly a part of Islamic teaching. Islamic, now, for a radical Islam, not quite so much. Because again, think of it this way. To understand radical Islamic theology and ideology, you have to go back. You have to, in some ways, go back in time to the ancient Middle East to begin to embrace and understand that. However, with that being said, while that forms the ideology and the theology, ISIS and radical Islam has not been slow to emerge in the world of cultural technology and understand how the importance of the technological can be used to recruit, to get their message out. So you have a group that's functioning on a modern global stage that is also operating out of ancient world ideology and theology, which, again, so when you use the word extreme, that's pretty extreme. It is that mindset that in some ways becomes so frightening, because most of us in this room, we can't even get on page with that. We don't understand that, right? Because, I mean, our sensitivities in American culture, yeah, we live and let live. You disagree with me? You disagree with me. We're okay with that.
Yeah. This one went on Facebook pretty long.
What's that?
Facebook.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but what happened?
Live on there, man.
Well, a lot of people live on there, but you know that ain't living. You know, but by the same token, but I mean, how often is it? I mean, and, you know, and I mean, if some of you, I mean, I know John very much understands this in a deeper way than any of us in the room can understand. But I mean, you know, one of the emerging battlefields in the battle against a world war on terror or defeating ISIS is that need to understand how to combat it even in a cyber world, which is nowhere near as simple as, we find a website, we'll kill it. I didn't do it. That's like killing weed in your yard. What happens next? 10 more pop up, right? I mean, so that's not it. But that is what's driving it. So it's not that you go, that's a bunch of backwater jerks that are doing this. Well, you know, they may be living where there's not a whole lot of water, but there is a mindset that drives them where, you know, you hate to say, let me say it this way, but they know what they're doing. And it's driven by this idea that we will take over the world. That is the end game. That's where they're trying to go. And so, let me give you the history of modern ISIS so we can get to the end of this, to get everything in.
Will we get to Russia then? Oh, yeah,
we get to Russia then. We get back around. Well, maybe we will. Let's just put it that way. Let me put this. I got to get three things in before we get to Russia.
Which means yes, questions.
So we'll see if we get two of them done. Stage one was the, you can pronounce it, best way works for you, the Mujahideen, or Mujahideen, Mujahideen. Arab Muslims brought Islam to Afghanistan in the mid-600s, and it's been a Muslim nation ever since. Okay? Political turmoil in the 70s led to a coup that deposed the reigning king and put the nation under the communist-leaning Mohammed Daoud Khan. Okay? Not the Khan from Star Trek, for you geeks in the room. Kirk took care of him. When the people of Afghanistan rose up against Khan, he appealed to Moscow for help. And in 1979, the Russians, having nothing to do with the prophecy like we were talking about, but invaded Afghanistan to put down the conservative Islamic tribal factions. The conservative Muslims, though, who waged guerrilla warfare, jihad, against the godless infidels from Russia, were known as the Mujahideen, which means holy warriors. Islamic Mujahideen from all over the Middle East streamed in Afghanistan to join the fight. It was a fight and it was a party. And in that group that flooded into Afghanistan to fight was the son of a Saudi billionaire by the name of Osama bin Laden. And by 1989, the Russians withdrew because they no longer had the stomach for the battle. And they calculated the cost, and they figured it wasn't in their best interest to keep fighting. And they left Afghanistan. It left Afghanistan in chaos. And for the most part, being under control of these terrorist groups. So withdrawal of the Russians brought stage two, which is known as the Taliban. You've heard that name. The withdrawal of the Russians left the leadership vacuum in Afghanistan. Mullah Muhammad Omar was the commander and war hero in the civil war that ousted the Russians. He started a movement with 50 followers that became known as the Taliban. Taliban means students. Became students. The movement grew rapidly. It increased his influence to the point that by the time the late 1990s emerged, he gained control of the government. His goal was to make Afghanistan a perfect Islamic state operating under Sharia law, which you're familiar with, you've heard about, we'll talk about later a lot. Bin Laden, by the way, pledged his loyalty to Omar and the Taliban. Stage three would be Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda. Depends on where you're from. If you're from Texas, Al-Qaeda. 2 years after the Russians left Afghanistan, a U.S. coalition invaded Kuwait to drive out Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army, which is at the first Gulf War. You will remember that. Muslims such as bin Laden viewed that U.S. action as another invasion of Islamic land. Bin Laden founded al-Qaeda to focus specifically on driving Westerners out of the Middle East by attacking Western targets, which ultimately led to the plan that allowed them to officially put a bounty on George H.W. Bush, who was the president of the time when we went into Iraq the first time, which also then allowed his planning and leadership to be the foiled plot on the World Trade Center that happened in the Clinton administration, as well as the September 11, 2001 attack that you're very familiar with that brought down the World Trade Center in New York City. Al-Qaeda became the world's most high-profile terror organization, and its leader, bin Laden, the world's most wanted man. Stage four, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is a little bit different. When the United States invaded Afghanistan in search of bin Laden and his lieutenants, Al-Qaeda decentralized. It began to spread out, and its leaders went into hiding, and they began to franchise operations that were set up in many different nations, most notably Iraq. And following the ouster of Saddam Hussein, the stronghold in Iraq grew deeper. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. But you remember him in the news. He was the most ruthless of all of the franchisees. He attacked American forces and Muslim forces equally. His members popularized suicide bombings, improvised explosive devices, and introduced or reintroduced on a global scale beheadings to instill fear in its enemies. Now, Americans killed al-Zarqawi, I got it, yeah, in 2006, and bin Laden in 2011. And with both men out of the picture, America announced on November 1st, 2012, that al-Qaeda had been destroyed and the war in Iraq was over, and almost over in Afghanistan. The victory claim ends up being premature. No matter what your politics, it's not that easy. And this is where we come back to where we started, and then we'll need to be done. Oliver's not done yet. He's just late. All right. He's waiting on me. So connect the dots with me. So let's wrap this up. The victory claim was premature, because the victory claim was based on right or wrong, worldview, politics aside, that the leaders, by killing the leaders, you killed the movement. And so then the policy that followed was, we're done, we come home. Now again, right, wrong, good, bad, the false assumption of that, though, was you kill the leader, the movement is over. Equate this, or just illustrate it in a way that we all understand. It was in the 60s that a U.S. president was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. By the end of the afternoon, another president had been sworn in, America continued and continues to continue to this day, because that's the way it was set up. So again, we should understand the Crossways misthinking that took place at that moment. But in a political climate, in news-driven cycles, in a world where people want to think by pundit, it became the move that was made. And so that opened the door then, with a U.S. pulling back in Iraq and Afghanistan, for the emergence of ISIS. And that occurred when Shiite Muslims returned to power, which reanimated Sunnite insurgents, al-Qaeda, against them. And a new leader emerged. His name, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And he took advantage of the leadership vacuum and rose to the top. And he was the most ruthless of all of his predecessors. And he formed what we know today as the Islamic State in Iraq. And now go back to what we talked about. That's where we are. We're done. Let's pray. We'll pick up next week. God, we thank you that you help us understand the world. And there is a way to understand, at least to some level, the things that go on, although it gets very confusing for us at times. Help us to have a biblical worldview that honors you. In Jesus' name, amen.